Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to the Universe Next Door, where today we're going to be putting a spotlight on one of the most important figures in the history of science, Charles Darwin. But we have with us an expert of the historical account about Darwin's life and his competitor, Alfred Wallace, on the phone with us from his office in the University of Birmingham, University of Alabama at Birmingham, is Professor Michael Flannery. He is the Associate Director for Historical Collections, and he works in the Lister Hill Library of Health Sciences. He is an author. He is a speaker. We really want to thank Professor Flannery, Michael Flannery, for joining us for, I believe, the second time on our program. Welcome, Professor Flannery.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And, of course, you are the official title with the Discovery Institute. Help us with that.
I am a Discovery Institute fellow.
Okay. I just want to make sure I had the term correct.
So, right.
As a fellow working with the Discovery Institute, it's your responsibility to do research and some publications. I'm holding in my hand a pair of very recent publications, the first of which is called Darwin Deleted, and I believe these came out just in April, so a short while ago, at evolutionnews.org. And if anyone is interested in downloading these fantastic two pieces, one a bit longer and then a follow-up shorter one, they both are from April of this year. And again, evolutionnews.org, and just click on the April listing of articles. You'll be able to go to the bottom of the current flow of articles and just click more articles, and you can bring up the April of 2013. And so your expertise, of course, is in various fields, but in relation to our program, you become one of the leading experts in the United States on the story of Alfred Wallace. And before we get to Darwin, could you fill us in and fill our listeners into who was Alfred Wallace and why is he so important?
Well, Alfred Russel Wallace is often referred to as the other man of evolution. Of course, everybody remembers Charles Darwin and his contribution with On the Origin of Species and Descent of Man and so on. And along the way, everybody forgot about Alfred Russel Wallace. Alfred Russel Wallace was an explorer, a naturalist. He was born in England on January 8th, as a matter of fact, 1823, and he died 100 years ago on November 7th, 1913. The claim to fame of Alfred Russel Wallace is he quite independently came up with the theory of natural selection while he was on the Ternate Island in the Malay Archipelago. He wrote this letter out describing and laying out his theory of natural selection in a letter during a bout with malaria. And in between his fevered bouts, he sketched out this letter, titled it On the Tendency of Varieties to Depart from the Original Type. And he sent it to Darwin in March of 1858. Darwin gets this letter in June, and he is absolutely shell-shocked. He was keeping pretty close wraps on his theory of evolution. And when he had seen this comparatively unknown and rather obscure naturalist send this letter completely outlining what he believed was essentially an identical theory to his own, he panicked. And he immediately gathered Charles Lyell and Joseph Hooker, his two close confidants, and he said, well, what do I do? I got this letter from Wallace. They said, look, what we'll do is we'll read Wallace's letter along with an 1844 sketch of your theory of evolution, along with a later letter to Asa Gray, famous American naturalist that he had corresponded with earlier, and we'll read Wallace's letter. And we'll read these three papers at the next Linnaean Society meeting, a very prestigious scientific society in London. And so the theory of evolution was unveiled formally on July the 1st, 1858, at that Linnaean Society meeting.
And of course, this took place a full year and some months before his book, The Origin of Species, appeared, correct?
Absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, that's what ultimately prompted Darwin to get his notes together, get a draft together, and submit a book-length manuscript to John Murray, which became On the Origin of Species, which would be published in November of 1859. He knew at that point he didn't have the luxury of languishing with this theory of his any longer, because he didn't know what else Wallace may have or what else Wallace may be working on. So to keep him from essentially being trumped in the process of discovery, Darwin immediately gathered his manuscript together and, as you suggest, published about a little over a year later.
And so this was really a kind of a kickstarting of the whole process of him going public. And just if you've just joined us today, we have with us on the phone Professor Michael Flannery. He is a world-renowned expert in a number of areas, but especially his recent work has been published in relation to the co-discoverer with Charles Darwin of the idea or the theory of natural selection, and the co-discoverer is the one that we're talking about, Alfred Russel Wallace, who sent this letter from the Malay Peninsula all the way across the world into the home there just south of London of Charles Darwin, who panicked. I love that word, panicked. By the way, Professor Flannery, one of the things that I thought I would just point out is that we actually acted this out in a recent chapel program at Trinity College in front of our audience. And we had the students that played Wallace, and he was on one side of the stage, and we had a postman carry the letter across the world to the other side of the stage.
Oh, wonderful. I would have loved to have been there.
Oh, yeah. And Justin Bailey, local grandson of Herman Sharon Bailey, played the part of Darwin beautifully. And it was a lot of fun. I think I need to make next time we perform that, I'll send you the video clip. But we were wanting to dive into something of the story of Alfred Wallace, but also, you might say, the invented or imagined story of what if Charles Darwin had not even lived to the end of that voyage on the Beagle and had fallen, let's say, overboard in December of 1832. And this is the scenario that is painted by Peter Buller in a new book, Darwin Deleted, Imagining a World Without Darwin. And now, Professor Flannery, you've really gone and done some deep analysis of this imaginary episode of Darwin having fallen overboard, and then it was just Wallace, basically, and maybe others involved in that whole story. And as we get into the next segments, we're going to get ready to take a break here in a little bit. Are you able to walk us through some of your thoughts in relation to this scenario of Peter Buller?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Again, today on the phone with us is Professor Michael Flannery, an expert in Alfred Wallace's life and his production of writings. And in about 30 seconds, why should people of the intelligent design movement be interested in Alfred Wallace? In other words, what did he say at the end of his life that might converge? We have about 30 seconds.
The very short answer is that Alfred Russel Wallace himself came to see design in nature and himself developed what I call a theory of intelligent evolution. And we can certainly talk more about that as the program goes on.
Yeah. And regardless of what we may think about that particular hybrid of two ideas, it still is fascinating that Alfred Wallace, the co-discoverer of the idea of the natural selection principle working in nature, ultimately came to view certain turning points in nature, like the consciousness of man, rationality of the human mind, as unable to be accounted for by the blind and blundering workings of matter. It requires a designer. Again, today with us, a very, very special edition of The Universe Next Door with Professor Michael Flannery talking about The Man Overboard, this scenario that is fascinating. We'll be right back on The Universe Next Door. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. Thanks for being with us. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we're taking, if it were in my ability to create a picture, to be a picture of Charles Darwin in midair, kind of flying rapidly downward with the pull of gravity toward the waves gushing around or sloshing around the Beagle as Darwin goes overboard. We're not wanting to cast Darwin overboard. I mean, he lived, he had an interesting life. He made a theory, the foundations of which are eroding rapidly in the scientific world, but he still is a person to be historically studied, honored for whatever, you know, good that we can find from his investigations, including, I might add, his desire that both sides be heard in this topic of origins. He said in his introduction to the book Origin of Species, he said a fair result can be obtained only by balancing the arguments and the evidences on both sides. Of course, he quickly says, I am not able to do that in my volume. But we honor the memory of Charles Darwin, who wanted a fair presentation of the evidence. And we think that that's what's missing in much of modern higher education when you deal with biology. Today, we have with us on the phone Professor Michael Flannery. He is the Associate Director for Historical Collections at the Lister Hill Library of Health Sciences. And he's a professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And for the interest of our topic today, he is an expert on the topic of not only Charles Darwin, but the competitor, if you will, the co-discoverer of the theory of natural selection, Alfred Wallace. Now, Dr. Flannery, Professor Flannery, you were saying a moment ago that we have this very interesting person who literally prompted Darwin to pull out of the shadows his idea, write the book quickly and get it out, because he realized he was about to be scooped by this somewhat of a friend. I think they were somewhat acquainted, Wallace and Darwin. And so I think when we get into the theory or the speculation by this scholar who just published Darwin Deleted, what would have happened? Let me read the name of the title. It's Darwin Deleted, Imagining a World Without Darwin. And this book, again, written by Peter J. Bowler, B-O-W-L-E-R, came out within the last, I guess, 6 or 8 months. And it asked this provocative question. And I think your point in the article that you wrote on this book, Darwin Deleted, is that his book, Bowler's book, as he's imagining Charles Darwin falling overboard, never living to even finish that voyage in the 1830s, it's more of an apologetic. He's like trying to write a defense of evolution and saying it wouldn't have had some of the social fruit. Am I getting you right?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Peter Bowler is a very prominent scholar. He's written, I think, a book now in its third edition called Evolution, the History of an Idea. Okay. And so he's very prominent. He's very, very well known in this field as a historian, and particularly a historian of Darwinian theory and development of evolution. And so, yeah, he put out this book, Darwin Deleted, Imagining a World Without Darwin. Now, from the very outset, and this is a direct quote from his book, he says, my interest in exploring what happens in a world without Darwin is driven by the hope of using history to undermine the claim that the theory of natural selection inspired various forms of social Darwinism. Mm. So what he's saying here in developing what most would call counterfactual history, uh-huh, what if kind of history, is that even if Darwin had not lived, even if Darwin had not gone on to write On the Origin of Species, had not gone on to write The Descent of Man and his many other publications, these untoward developments like eugenics, using evolutionary theory and so forth to manipulate mankind into a better race of being, for example, which is what the idea of eugenics was.
Like somebody, if you have, let's say, an IQ below 70 or 75, you cannot breed, we will sterilize you.
Right. Sterilization of the unfit. In fact, more than 65,000 Americans were sterilized on that basis.
Wow.
In the early 20th century, there were many state sterilization laws in an attempt to eliminate the so-called unfit. This is Bowler's purpose. He's saying, look, even without Darwin, these things would have occurred. And so I thought, well, this is a fascinating way to approach a question. So I looked at this and I said, well, what would a world without Darwin look like? And one of the things that I think is absolutely plausible, Bowler doesn't want to, he sort of dismisses it, but I find his dismissals rather weak and unconvincing, is that what if we had had an evolutionary scenario not developed by Charles Darwin and his cadre of ex-club supporters like Thomas Henry Huxley, his bulldog defender, and so forth, but what if we had had a different scenario in which modern evolutionary theory is actually developed by Alfred Russell Wallace in conjunction with Charles Lyell. Now, the reason I link Charles Lyell in there is that Wallace was not a well-born man like Charles Darwin was. Charles Darwin was born into wealth and privilege. He came from a family of physicians. He was well thought of. He was independently wealthy. Darwin himself never really had to work to live. He had excellent investments, and he was, within the context of Victorian society, one of those well-kept elites that people would want to see and be seen with.
Well, that's a great sketch of Charles Darwin's background, his elite and wealthy sort of situation.
Or well-heeled, yeah.
Well-heeled young man. What's the deal with Alfred Wallace? Can you give us a kind of a sketch of his situation?
Well, Wallace was entirely different. You might say Wallace certainly came from the other side of the tracks, as it were. He was a common man. He had spent time with the laboring classes in London as a young man, had very little formal education, learned surveying from his brother, but then as a surveyor, spending a lot of time outdoors, had an interest in nature, which absolutely captivated him. And so he found a friend, Walter Bates, and they got together and went to South America, spent 4 years there. He came back to London dissatisfied with his work there. He wanted to do more and decided to spend 8 years in the Malay Archipelago. So that's really where he gained his expertise as a naturalist. But it was all definitely working for a wage. He would collect specimens and send those back to his agent in London, and those would be sold, and that's literally how he made a living. Whereas Darwin really was independently wealthy, didn't have to work and make a living. So they were very different. Well, that leads to my point in talking about Peter Bowler's book. In developing a counter to Darwin Deleted, I speculated, well, what would a world that had developed evolutionary theory through Alfred Russel Wallace look like? Well, Wallace never had the social standing to present on his own as Darwin did a theory like this. He would have to have some entree to that. And the entree in the Victorian world could have easily come through his friend Charles Lyell.
Let me just jump in, and just for the sake of those who've just joined us, our guest today is Professor Michael Flannery, and he is a fellow of the Discovery Institute. He's tackling the question raised in this book by Peter Bowler, Darwin Deleted. What would have happened if Charles Darwin had fallen overboard and had never written his theory of natural selection in the book Origin of Species, and if it had just fallen to other people? And of course, Professor Flannery, a world-renowned expert on the life of Alfred Wallace, the co-discoverer of the principle of natural selection, is dealing with this speculation and analyzing what might make sense and what might not make sense. And of course, of great interest to me is Charles Lyell. I'm going to be introducing in our next segment my background and what I talk about in relation to Lyell and the history of evolution. We'll be right back on The Universe Next Door as we plumb the depths of what would have happened if it was man overboard. We'll be right back here on The Universe Next Door after a quick break. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where we're having a very lively and kind of fun conversation with Professor Michael Flannery. He's on the phone with us from his office there at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, a wonderful campus, especially Professor Flannery working in the library collections, historical collections of the Lister Hill Library. And he's working with, adjunct appointments in the departments of history and sociology, in addition to the health sciences and the medical area. He has been known in the area of pharmacy, the history of pharmacy. He received an award for outstanding scholarship there as an American writer. He has been publishing in the area of medical ethics. Dr. Flannery, Professor Flannery, I just find this fascinating, the wide variety of topics that you have touched. So you must be having a lot of fun in your both teaching, writing, as well as your librarian purposes there.
I am. I live in the best of both worlds.
That's great. Well, as we prepare to jump back into this scenario, which has kind of been raised by Peter Bowler's new book, Darwin Deleted, Imagining a World Without Darwin, how it might have been different. And of course, in a way, he's trying to save the honor of the evolutionary theory in general by saying, we wouldn't have had necessarily any difference in the social spinning out of history with all these social ills. So we should then exonerate Darwinism for having any crucial causal purposeful trigger effect to produce these social ills, such as racial hygiene and so forth. But you're bringing up Wallace, but also his potential alliance that might have developed between him and Charles Lyell. Let me just quickly, in 30 seconds or so, say that Charles Lyell was a major figure in geology. He began his career as an attorney, lawyer, barrister, it may be the term in England, and he lost his sight, and somewhere around the time of the 1840s and 50s, he began a series of publications on the geology of not only England, but the world, and proposed, really took Hutton's idea and proposed a uniformitarian view of geology, that the forces of nature that are sculpting the earth today are the same gradual forces that sculpted or created the geological landscape of the past. And this uniformitarian theory, of course, is one that Darwin used as a premise. It's like a preparation for his view. I would open up the door, Professor Flannery, for you to critique what I've said. Am I okay? Am I in the ballpark of truth with Lyell?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Charles Lyell was very prominent in geology. And in fact, he was even very prominent as a figure in science generally in the Victorian era. He had been knighted. He was Sir Charles Lyell. And so he was quite an established figure. Now, if I may continue the sort of Lyell-Wallace connection.
Yes, please do.
Now, Lyell was already familiar with Wallace's Sarawak Law paper, which was published in 1855, which appeared in the September issue of the Annals and Magazine of Natural History. Historian Ian McCalman has called it the first ever British scientific paper to claim that animals had descended from a common ancestor and then produced closely similar variations which evolved into distinct species. Now, Lyell immediately recognized the importance of this paper, and he urged Darwin to take serious note of it. And it's apparently advice which Darwin seems to have ignored, or he wouldn't have been so surprised when he got the paternate letter. At any rate, no scientist of the period exerted more influence upon Wallace than Lyell. And from 1863 to 1872, the two men really saw each other frequently during the Wallace's residency in London. And there seems little doubt that Lyell's geological evidences of the antiquity of man, which came out in 1863, had a profound influence. Lyell insisted that the whole course of nature may be the material embodiment of a preconcerted arrangement. And if the succession of events be explained by transmutation, and he said the perpetual adaptation of the organic world to new conditions leaves the argument in favor of design. Now, that's what Lyell had said. Now, this one historian has referred to Wallace and Lyell as forming a philosophic kinship. And Wallace himself admitted that Lyell was one of the few scientific leaders with whom he felt entirely at ease. So it's not surprising that when there was a break with Darwin between Wallace over this whole issue of teleology or purpose in nature, which came about in the 1869 April issue of the Quarterly Review, in which Wallace called upon an overruling intelligence to explain the mental properties of human beings. Actually, Lyell approved of it. When Darwin complained to Lyell about Wallace's defection, Lyell said, and this is a quote, "I rather hail Wallace's suggestion that there may be a supreme will and power which may not abdicate its functions of interference, but may guide the forces and laws of nature."
Well, this is a bombshell. I mean, this is a major turning point. I mean, I feel a bit embarrassed that I'm not that familiar with this break between Charles Darwin, at least a break of sorts. You said this is 1869, just 10 years after the publication of Origin of Species?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so this, the idea of Wallace and Lyell, the great geologist Lyell, both seeing a purpose in nature, in a way, is something of a heresy, wasn't it, for Darwin?
Yeah, it was. You know, and what's funny is Peter Bowler even admits that Lyell wanted a natural theory of species production, but he wanted to also believe that it was somehow purposeful. Hmm. This is what Bowler writes. Well, this is exactly what Wallace delivered: directed, detectably designed, and purposeful common descent. So I think an alternative scenario without Darwin could have been what I call a Lyell-Wallace theory of evolution, which from the beginning would have had intrinsic to it intelligent design.
And therefore would not have the same gloss or implications of agnosticism, at least, of the Darwinian theory or some kind of material.
No. Yeah. No, not at all. In fact, it would have changed everything, I think. Mm. Wallace was a vocal opponent of the eugenics movement. Had he been front and center in the development of evolutionary theory, I don't think there would have been a eugenics movement, because it was founded by Darwin's own cousin, Sir Francis Galton, who said the theory of eugenics precisely by reading Darwin's Origin of Species. Well, if there's no origin of species, who's going to develop the theory of eugenics?
Well, let me just
The answer is nobody.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate. Wouldn't it have been likely in this scenario, Professor Flannery, that some atheist or some materialist, naturalistic thinking, in other words, God being equivalent of the great pumpkin rising from the pumpkin patch, that's total mythology. Right. Wouldn't there have been the possibility of some person inclining that way to seize a Wallace theory and then move it more toward the Darwinian stripe?
Well, it's conceivable. The problem in my scenario, the difference would have been what counted as legitimate science would have been held and controlled by a Lyell-Wallace paradigm.
Okay.
And so an individual coming from the outside, let's say like Huxley, coming and saying, oh, well, all of this, maybe we do need eugenics, maybe we need to encourage the unfit. Wallace would have vocally opposed that. Mm. And so the atheistic or agnostic naysayers would have been on the outside trying to get in. But Wallace would have vocally opposed this, and he would have had some pretty powerful reasons for opposing it. Hmm. So I just don't see, would there have been an idea of perhaps something like eugenics without Darwin? Yes. Would it have turned into a movement? I don't see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me just, again, reset the picture here. We have a fascinating conversation, which we'll be having to take a quick break from, but we will be returning with Professor Michael Flannery to discuss the idea of Darwin deleted. This is a commentary, of course, fascinating to the extreme, with Professor Flannery talking about the new book, Darwin Deleted, Imagining a World Without Darwin. Professor Flannery is also an expert in his own right on Alfred Wallace, the co-discoverer of natural selection. We'll be right back with him and this discussion after a quick break on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to our special program with Professor Michael Flannery of the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is a professor there and working in the areas of sociology, history of science, the history of pharmacology and medicine. And he is an expert on the true story, the history, really, of Alfred Wallace, the co-discoverer of natural selection. So, I mean, as we were discussing these incredible points of historical fact that you have enlightened us, the potential alliance of Charles Lyell, the famous, really uniformitarian geologist of that era, the one who established uniformitarianism as this unshakable, for at least a century, kind of paradigm within which geology must work. I mean, these are incredibly important facts for anybody who can just spend a few minutes evaluating the place of Charles Darwin. Speaking of key books, massive breakthrough books, I think, Professor Flannery, that you are about as excited as I am about Steve Meyer's book coming out just in a matter of weeks. From Harper One, a big secular publisher, is bringing out what could prove to be one of the greatest bombshell books in the history of the intelligent design movement. We're going to be doing special coverage of it, Darwin's Doubt. Are you pretty excited about that?
I'm pretty excited. I have my copy on order. So,
well, that's
looking forward to it.
I do too. And we're going to be, of course, featuring an interview with Steve Meyer right about the time the book is published. We'll be planning to have him here in Tampa Bay, and maybe we can do some other exciting things to feature what, for many people who have read the book, I actually haven't seen it. I've just seen summaries of it. They have said it's a game changer. It may be to intelligent design what Charles Darwin's own book, Origin of Species, was to evolution. How about that, Bill?
There you go.
That's a pretty strong analogy. So back to this discussion, this exciting scenario, kind of a what if, that if Charles Darwin had never even lived to see the end of the voyage of the Beagle in the 1830s, if he'd never produced a single monograph or in a discussion paper, book, or anything on evolutionary theory, what would have happened if it would have been just Wallace, the other guy who came up with the theory and wrote Darwin that fateful letter? that prodded him to actually write his book. Now, I'm looking in your paper. This, of course, is available at evolutionnews.org under the title Darwin Deleted. It's in early April of this year. It says here, Pickens, we'll go into the great details of what Pickens is saying in general, but historian Donald Pickens, you say, rightly identifies Darwin not primarily as a scientist, but as a philosopher. Wow. Let me continue reading your quote here. Professor Flannery, you're saying, understanding how Darwin contributed not just to new scientific ideas, but also to philosophical naturalism is essential. The two cannot be separated in any coherent discussion of his purported impact upon the larger culture. So to think of Darwin, or to identify Darwin as not primarily a scientist, but as a philosopher, is itself, that's a pretty big blow to the current conception of him, is it not? And isn't that a significant point?
I think if you look at Darwin's theory and you look at those aspects of the theory that were regarded as most revolutionary, mm-hmm. because after all, there had been theories of evolution well before Darwin, you know, certainly Lamarck and so forth. But if you look at the aspects that made his theory so revolutionary, most of those assumptions are essentially metaphysical assumptions. That is, that change that occurred between species occurred wholly randomly through chance or undirected processes. And that is essentially a metaphysical statement. That is not what I would regard necessarily as an empirically demonstrable statement so much as it is a metaphysical commitment. And more particularly, when you look at how Darwin developed his theory, what he's really developing is a theory of methodological naturalism. And that's just a fancy phrase for the notion that scientists must invoke only natural processes functioning via unbroken natural laws in non-purposeful ways. Well, that's really not a scientific statement. That's a statement about how science should be pursued. It's therefore a philosophical statement. And so when I think when you look at Darwin's overall theory, the most significant portions of it, the things that put it on the history of science map, as it were, are principally metaphysical and not per se scientific. Because in terms of empirical evidence for common descent and so on, there were other avenues for that. And in fact, Lamarck had suggested an evolutionary theory well before Darwin.
Okay, on the phone with us today, Michael Flannery, Associate Director of Historical Collections at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, author, lecturer, and expert on Alfred Wallace, among many other topics. Professor Flannery, as we are imagining this world without Darwin, then the very important role of philosophical naturalism, the no-God picture of the universe, that's absolutely the key contribution to modern culture. And yet the writer of this book, Darwin Deleted, Professor Bowler, seems to be giving Darwin a get out of jail free card, to use your term. I love that. And so he's basically letting Darwin off the hook, saying, well, you know, if naturalism didn't come, you know, oozing in or leaking in from Darwin's book, it would have come in from other sources. And so Bowler admits Darwin's broader impact upon society, you say. He admits his role in shifting the generation toward this new naturalistic perspective. But he says other forces would have done the same thing. What is your response to that?
Well, one of the problems that Peter Bowler has is he wants to assume, for example, particularly when he talks about the human mind, he wants to assume that these questions have already been answered in other avenues through modern science. he seems to imply that a naturalistic explanation, for example, for the human intellect is a settled question, arising from what he considers to be certain proofs in the neurosciences. But this is by no means a settled case. I mean, James Lefanu, who is a physician, a British physician, paints a very different picture in a book called Why Us, which came out just a few years ago. He talks about the 1990s, the decade of the brain, proposed that new technologies would unlock the secrets of the human mind, but really those hopes ended in failure. Chris Smith has even called the mind Darwin's unsolved problem.
Let me just point that out. Chris Smith, a scholar, has even called the mind Darwin's unsolved problem. That's huge, isn't it?
Well, I think it is, and I think, you know, to just, you know, sort of brush away these questions about the nature of the human mind as though, you know, modern neuroscience is, you know, basically reduced it all to the operations of the organ of the brain is, well, let's just say it's premature at best. In fact, there's a sizable body of good peer-reviewed scientific literature that really questions this. And so I think for Peter Buller just to assume that, well, you know, naturalism has been proven empirically in modern science is, I think, hopeful on his part, at best premature, and, you know, by no means substantiated in the scientific literature itself.
Well, as we're winding up our discussion, we have about 2.5 minutes left here. I want to just read, if I could, some of the major conclusions at the end of your paper. Lyle Wallace paradigm, in other words, if Darwin had fallen overboard and if it was left to this other co-discoverer, Alfred Wallace, and maybe working in conjunction with Charles Lyell, if they had propounded, if they had developed a new paradigm, evolution would have been modeled within a context of intelligent design. That seems shocking, but based on your description of Wallace's approach, he did not rule out purpose, correct?
Well, he not only did not rule out intelligent design, but he wrote two books, one in 1903 called Man's Place in the Universe,
wow,
which talked about man's unique place in the universe. And basically, it is sort of a an early precursor to a book that you may have had on your show before called The Privileged Planet.
Oh, well, yes.
Well, this is essentially Wallace previewing what Jay Richards and Guillermo Gonzalez would later write many years later in The Privileged Planet, that we live in a unique place in the universe, and all of the tight controls that are required not only for life, but for a sophisticated kind of life and diversity of nature like we see on Earth, appear to be absolutely unique in the universe. And Wallace suggested that in Man's Place in the Universe in 1903. And then in 1910, he wrote what I really regard as his magnum opus, or, you know, his grand evolutionary synthesis called The World of Life. Mm-hmm. And the World of Life was really his, I would say, his grand statement of what he believed evolutionary theory meant. And let me just, I'll just give you the subtitle and that explains it all. He called it The World of Life, a manifestation of creative power, directive mind, and ultimate purpose.
Well, thank you so much, Michael Flannery, for introducing us to this hypothetical situation and how it would have turned out differently. See you back here next week on The Universe Next Door.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.